I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. Migrant children crying after being separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border earlier this year. It became one of the defining sounds of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. Starting in April, the zero-tolerance policy led to more than 2,600 children being separated from their parents and sparked widespread criticism. In response, President Trump signed an executive order ending family separation at the border in late June.
It's about keeping families together while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, but we're going to keep the families together. I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated.
A week later, a federal judge ordered all families who had been separated to be reunited. But there was an exemption in the judge's ruling. And because of that loophole, months after the administration claimed to stop the practice, families are still being torn apart. I'm joined now by Ginger Thompson, senior reporter with ProPublica. Ginger was the reporter who first gained access to the detained children we just heard at the top. And this week, she broke the news that families are still being separated at the border. Ginger, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So what exactly is the exemption from the federal judge's ruling that's allowing families to continue to be separated?
So basically, the judge in the Missel ruling put an exemption in the ruling that allowed authorities to continue separating children in the cases where they believe that the child was at risk, or that their parent threatened the child's safety in some way.
Is this I want to make sure that we're clear. This has nothing to do with the zero tolerance policy that we were focusing on over the summer. Is that right?
Well, that's what the administration says, yes, that these are not zero-tolerance separations, that they are separations that are being conducted according to the ruling. In fact, Customs and Border Protection pointed out to me in an email that, in fact, the ruling that ended zero-tolerance explicitly allows separations in these kinds of cases.
How many children have continued to be separated from their parents at the border since Trump signed that executive order in late June?
We don't know. The Border Patrol declined to tell me how many separations there are. And what has immigrant attorneys and advocates concerned is that the government's not reporting these separations to anyone. And so children end up in foster care or in shelters without any information accompanying them that indicates that they had been separated from parents at the border. So the child that I wrote about, for example, landed in New York. He's a 4-year-old child. There were no documents with him that indicated that he had been separated from his father and that his father was still in detention in South Texas. And so the concern is that these may not be zero-tolerance separations, but they're separations that are being conducted a lot like they were under the zero-tolerance program, where there were no records attaching children to the parents who had brought them here. And that lack of record-keeping puts these children at risk of being lost in the system.
Ginger, what's the criteria, if there is an established criteria, that border agents are using to determine whether or not a parent or guardian, in this case, is dangerous to a child?
Again, Tanzina, that is precisely what everyone is concerned about. We don't know what standards the Border Patrol is using to make these decisions, and this is what is so dangerous about having an immigration system where so many decisions are made in secret, right? And the system allows it, so we don't know exactly how they make these decisions and what standards they're using to make these decisions, whether they've even had any training in family welfare to make these kinds of decisions. And so in the case that I wrote about, they've claimed that this man, the father, is a gang member But they've so far provided absolutely no evidence, not to me, not to his attorney, not to the judge in an immigration court where he appeared a couple of days ago, no evidence that supports this claim that he's a gang member. And the advocates say, look, there are cases where the child's safety is at stake and where separations make sense. But they can't tell when that happens because there are no records, and there's no sort of oversight in these decisions. There's a lot weighing on them. The, you know, health and welfare of these children is at stake.
And who's paying for this?
Taxpayers are paying for this, and it's an incredibly expensive undertaking, the holding of these children just in Tornillo, which is a detention facility near El Paso, Texas, one of the largest detention facilities in the country, has more than 1,500 kids, I believe, minors, could cost by the end of the year more than $400 million for holding these children. So it's an extraordinary expense.
And do we know how taxpayers feel about this? Are they aware of the amount of money that's being put towards this?
It's unclear to me, Tanzina. I can't say that I have a good grasp of, you know, how the taxpayers feel. I feel that the country overall is very divided about this program, about how to handle children. Just after the publication of my story, you know, I've had people tweet at me that, you know, this is the parents' fault, that the parents who are bringing these children are responsible for how they're treated by the immigration system and how their children are treated by the immigration system. And I have, you know, many people who are upset and disturbed that the United States would treat immigrant children this way. So just, you know, the feedback that I get from these kinds of stories suggests to me that the country is divided over this.
It's interesting. As we're talking, I'm thinking about, on the one hand, the secrecy of these decisions, the safety of these children seems to be at the very top of, or at least appears to be at least at the top of the list here. However, I think about the images just from this week of tear gas and children being tear gassed at the border and the current administration's policies limiting asylum and who can claim it. So it feels like I'm having trouble reconciling this idea that the Border Protection wants to protect children on the one hand and on the other hand isn't really allowing for that to happen.
I think what this administration is showing with these kinds of policies and with these kinds of decisions is that its priority is sending signals to parents about the challenges they'll face if they want to try to seek asylum in this country, and that the health and welfare of these children seems to be a secondary matter to them.
Ginger Thompson is a senior reporter with ProPublica. Ginger, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
We treat these people, these economic refugees, as if they're zombies from The Walking Dead. We have to deal with this problem humanely and with compassion. These are not invaders. For goodness sake, I can't we suspend our humanity when it comes to this issue, and I fear that it is because they look different than the
Geraldo Rivera there reacting to the weekend's tear gassing of migrants at the border. So what does our treatment of migrants tell us about how we view humanity and who's deserving of it? Many of us are taught that the United States is a beacon for human rights, but our history, starting well before today, suggests that not only may we be failing in that mission, but we have in the past. So how do our standards around human rights align with our actions? To help us make sense of this is Zach Cheney Rice, a staff writer with Intelligencer for New York Magazine. Hi, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
And Samuel Moyne, a professor of law and history at Yale. Samuel, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Zach, I want to start with you. You wrote a piece for New York Magazine that focused on what we were just talking about, the images of children being tear gassed at the border. You, in your piece, said that this is a deliberate tactic that's been used in the past. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I think that we have to understand what happened at the border this weekend in the context of protest. In part, these people have increasingly narrow legal avenues through which to seek asylum, and the crackdown that was in response to their agitating against the border policy and in some cases trying to rush the border you know, that's part of this follows a long history of children being used as sort of collateral in crackdowns on protest. And the example that I used in my piece was the Birmingham Children's Crusade during the Civil Rights Movement, where, you know, violence against children enacted by Bull Connor, you know, lacerating their flesh with fire hoses and beating them with batons and sicking police dogs on them. These are all meant to serve as deterrents against people demanding human rights and people whose claims to citizenship were very precarious, if not being denied outright. In that case, it was Black Americans. Today, it's migrants from Central America mostly. And it's a pretty clear reflection of a pattern that's been enacted throughout our history.
Samuel, I want to bring you in here. When we talk about migrants making their way to the United States, how is that, and what do we mean in terms of that being a human rights story? And what are we missing in that conversation?
Well, I think we should first recognize that there's a very limited human right to asylum. In human rights law, you have the right to leave your country, but not to enter any other, even if you have pressing economic need. Only if you have a well-founded fear of persecution, which some of these migrants say they have based on gangs at home, for example, can you enter another country. The trouble is that the right is so narrow, and the United States historically has tried to avoid granting it, and that's what it's doing now.
It's tried to avoid granting it because...
Well, because of a long history in which it's welcomed a lot of people, but also tried to keep a lot of others at bay, especially when they're the wrong color. That's a history that goes back a long time.
Right. And that's something I'm thinking, you know, we've often talked about the United States, said this at the top of the show, as being this beacon of freedom. I want to talk a little bit about where these notions come from historically, Samuel.
So it's true that the United States was founded on the idea of human rights and the Declaration of Independence. But from the beginning, that meant kicking out a lot of people on the wrong side of the Revolution, clearing the land of Native Americans, enslaving Blacks. And then in the late 19th century, we set up pretty strict immigration controls in the face of Asian migration that have lasted more or less to the present, with some periods of greater generosity. And so the United States is founded on human rights, but also has a mixed record in recognizing the idea that all kinds of people may deserve to enter.
Zach, when you saw the images of mothers and other people running from what's essentially a chemical attack, what were some of the first thoughts that came to mind?
Well, I think initially you have to look at this from a strategic standpoint on the part of the Trump administration. I think that for the past few weeks, Trump and his allies in the Republican Party and conservative media have done their best to gin up as much fear as possible around the approaching migrant caravan from Honduras. And part of that was casting these people without any evidence as criminals and terrorists, overwhelmingly, when, you know, all reporting was to the contrary. We saw that there were several small children being brought by their mothers, and these were, for all intents and purposes, and from what anybody could really tell, these were just people fleeing violence in Central America and seeking economic opportunity in the United States. But the Trump administration, I think, for weeks has been conditioning us for violence against these people by casting them as an imminent threat to the United States. So when I saw the tear gassing of these people and their children, it seemed like a pretty logical culmination of that strategy to make us conditioned and make us prepared emotionally for violence against these people. And I think that's part of why it's been allowed to go on as long as it has, starting with the child separation policies and even before, and continuing to this weekend.
Samuel, I want to ask you also, there's a really important point that Zach just brought up, really about rhetoric coming from the administration, also coming from the media and its choice of language. When we think about history and in the United States' record, if you will, which we sort of touched on earlier on who we let out and who we let in, how much does rhetoric have to do with that and ginning up that type of fear of the other?
Everything. History shows that whatever moral standards we may say we believe in the end, if hatred is whipped up, it will prevail. And it really long has. We're seeing things that are worse right now, but Barack Obama's presidency involves some use of tear gas and pepper spray at the border. One silver lining, if you can find one in the current situation, is that because of the current president, we're looking much more closely at the brutality of the government at the border and elsewhere. And the question is whether you can change culture and rhetoric. It seems easier to whip up a frenzy against otherness than to show that people are not criminals and terrorists and that they do have at least this narrow right to make their case to enter.
You know, I'm wondering, too, given the history of the United States, of our country, Zach, you wrote about this in your piece, you know, we're here in 2018. Why have we fallen back into a lot of these patterns? I mean, are they just ingrained in who we are as Americans? This issue that, you know, we can't seem to get to a place where we don't look at refugees, migrants, brown people, poor people as the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to be specific about who we're talking about. I think the Trump administration, at least its attitude towards immigration, has expressed a pretty explicitly white nationalist project where national identity is sort of cemented by narrowly defining who belongs in the United States and who does not. And that has, for, you know, the past several years under Trump, largely hinged and revolved around this idea of the sort of traditional white understanding of American citizenship.
But why do we keep falling for it, though, Zach? That's the thing. Like, I don't know why most Americans seem to keep falling for this.
I think it's incredibly appealing to a lot of people, I think, especially in times of uncertainty, especially in times where I think a major component of why it's happening now is demographic change and a sense of a sort of changing sense of who has visibility and who has power in the United States, which substantially hasn't changed that dramatically. But the optics are that these people have had to watch a black man in the White House for the past 8 years. They've seen more and more non-white children being born in the United States. They've seen what they understand as a much more generous immigration policy, letting in a lot of different looking people. And I think that scares people. And I think, you know, paired with a lot of other struggles that they might be going through on a day-to-day basis, it's easy and it's a simple answer to scapegoat people who aren't here already. It's a simple answer to scapegoat immigrants. It's a simple answer to scapegoat minorities. And I think that this is a constant throughout United States history, and I don't know that it ever won't be.
And at the same time, Samuel, we talk about the United States where it's ingrained in us as since we're kids about how we are the land of the free. We stand up for human rights here and around the world. And yet this is our current practice. These ideas seem to be in direct opposition and contradiction. Could you help us understand that?
Well, it's tough to explain, but we have to go back to the fact that the idea of human rights for Americans meant founding a nation for whites. And the very idea that America could be a place honoring diverse identities and diverse colors is very recent. And when people are anxious about things in their lives, it's common to scapegoat them. Sadly, the alt, not just in the United States, has played on fears of migrant caravans going back 30 years. And this is perfect for those who really want to divert us from whatever the real issues are that concern people and lead them to project their fears on others who are not dangerous. In the end, the United States has been welcoming on and off. And the question is how we get our fellow citizens to look past their fears and see other parts of the traditions they've slowly learned to see other people as humans and potentially fellow citizens.
Samuel Moyn is a professor of law and history at Yale, and Zach Cheney Rice is a staff writer with Intelligencer for New York Magazine. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is Terry Mintz from Bend, Oregon. Slavery, misogyny, the Trail of Tears, religious intolerance, the Japanese internment. I could go on and on naming the ways in every decade that this country failed to live up to its promise to be a beacon of human rights. But this country was conceived and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, and the Statue of Liberty plaque contains the words by which we should raise this country and make it, for the first time in its history, great.
My name is Mark from San Juan Capistrano. basic human rights in America right now? Absolutely not. And the apparent evidence is with the practice of gerrymandering, voting districts, and excluding minorities from being able to vote.
This is Andrea Hollander in Portland, Oregon. Now our country's actions and resulting reputation in regards to human rights have taken a huge plunge.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
You probably know that voice, James Baldwin. Since his death in 1987, Baldwin's work continues to thrive and be shared. But no American filmmaker has attempted to adapt Baldwin's novels for the screen until Barry Jenkins.
For me, Baldwin represented kind of everything, you know, just the freedom with which he expressed himself was always something that was quite meaningful.
Baldwin just represented someone who wasn't afraid to speak the truth and speak the truth about his experiences and just owning his truth, owning his experiences, regardless of what anyone else had to say about it.
That's actress Kiki Layne, who stars in Barry Jenkins' adaptation of Baldwin's 1974 book, If Beale Street Could Talk. Jenkins is perhaps best known for his 2016 Oscar-winning film Moonlight. Beale Street tells the story of Fonny, played by Stephan James, and Tish, who's played by Layne. And they're a black couple who are deeply in love, but separated by a false rape accusation. Ahead of the release of If Beale Street Could Talk, I sat down with Layne and Jenkins to discuss how they captured the love between Fonny and Tish for the film.
I haven't seen two young black people portrayed as soulmates like that. It just feels like from the beginning of time that it was always meant to be them. So I think that stood out to me a lot about Tish and Fonny's relationship.
And Barry, how did you get that level of intimacy between Tish and Fonny? Because you have this ability to really hit these emotional places that I think a lot of people don't know how to articulate, whether that's in words or on the screen.
Yeah, I don't think that's something that I kind of know how to create. You know, I think part of it is the text. You know, I think Baldwin created, you know, a pair of characters who very clearly jump off the page as soulmates. But then also, you know, Kiki and Stefan just really going to this place where the feeling you have in reading the text and reading the source material is the feeling you have in watching these two young people live out their lives. You know, we didn't do any chemistry reads on the previous film, but for Beale Street, we did do a chemistry read between Stefan and Kiki, and it was very clear to me that there was this connection. Because when you think of soulmates, you know, that's not verbal. You know, that's a feeling. And it just felt like these two people, they shared this feeling.
And I mean, was it an authentic feeling when you were doing, like they said, the chemistry read and everything else, Kiki? Like, was it something that you had to tell? You said you'd never seen that portrayed in media mm-hmm. before.
I think it was just me and Stefan just understood how important the love between these two characters was. It is the story. And so I think we were both committed to, you know, letting our walls down, being vulnerable and being open. And I think we recognized that in each other in the chemistry read of like, oh, this is somebody that is willing to play with me, is willing to go there, you know, with me, even though we don't know each other. And so I think that was where the strength came in our in me and Stefan building that relationship.
It also says a lot, I think, about the director and the rest of the film, if you're feeling that you can be vulnerable. That's a really difficult thing to be, even in acting, right?
Oh, yeah. Barry created such a safe environment for us to go there and to just dive in with each other. And I think that was just all the way around, not even just, you know, me and Stefan, just the whole cast, I think, could feel just this really safe place to just go there, because I mean, we have to in just so many different places in this film, just really just let it all out and just really be that vulnerable, be that open, be that emotional.
Barry, how do you do that?
I don't, you know, I don't know, again, that I know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, for me, it's about working in the same way that we've always worked. You know, my closest collaborators are people I went to film school with. So we've been working together for, I don't know, like 18, almost 20 years now. And that creates, you walk on the set and the crew itself is kind of a family, you know? And I think that, you know, with these moments where the actor's looking directly to camera, that has to be the safest space because it's such an awkward, such an artificial thing to do, yet the whole point is to remove artifice from the performance. And so I think by creating a space, you know, where the actors feel comfortable, where the crew feels comfortable, you kind of like inspire, you engender, you know, this authenticity in the performance.
We'll have more of my conversation with Barry Jenkins and Kiki Layne just ahead. Stay with us.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made from scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait, order today.
Tanzina Vega back with you on The Takeaway. And we're continuing my conversation now with Barry Jenkins, the director of If Beale Street Could Talk, and its star, Kiki Layne. The film is a love story, first and foremost, but it's also the story of a black family caught up in a corrupt criminal justice system. I asked Jenkins how he balanced the romance with the broader issues of racism and mass incarceration.
It was quite tricky. You know, it takes 20 hours to read the book, but only about 2 hours to watch the film. And so there needs to be this idea of balance is even more important. You know, what I loved about the book for the first time was that there was this duality between the story of the romance between Tish and Fani, you know, and the systemic injustice, you know, this thing, this taking to task, the judicial system, you know, the mass incarceration and all those things. But it's like, what's the film about? The film was about the characters, and the characters are in love. And so the whole point was to allow that love to drive the film, but to also pay due diligence to the circumstances of how the lives of black folks can be taken so quickly, you know, by a faulty judicial system.
And in terms of the casting of the film, there's an interesting choice that you made when we talk about the issue of what's in the book versus what's in the film, mm-hmm. specifically around colorism. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the choice that you made there.
Yeah, in the book, Stephon James's character, Fani, is written to be purposely or intentionally lighter skinned than Tish and her family. And I think Mr. Baldwin was really digging into these issues of colorism and how it plays into status, how it plays into class, typically in the black community, especially in the time that this book was set. And I wanted to honor the text, and we explored trying to very diligently, you know, honor this dynamic of colorism. But, you know, Stephon James just gave, you know, an amazing, amazing performance. And to be brutally honest, you know, typically the way this goes is that the character is written dark skin and cast light skin. And so it felt like in this situation, if we were going to go against the grain, that it would be kind of cool to go against the grain in this way and cast a light skin character dark skin. Now, the upshot of that is people come into the cinema and they see, you know, and we project this movie in IMAX, they see Kiki Layne and Stephon James, these two dark-skinned black people, just loving each other, as Kiki said, being soulmates. And I can't intellectually account for the feeling that places in certain people's hearts, but it's a damn good one.
I think it's extremely powerful, particularly, I mean, the issue of colorism is not new in Hollywood,
exactly.
And it's one that has gotten, you know, I think about the Nina Simone debacle. They did everything but cast somebody that looked like Nina Simone, right? And had the dark skin and the features that Nina had. And so I think it's an interesting choice that you made. Do you feel that way, Kiki? Do you think it matters, like, beyond just the love story here?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, to look the way that I look and I'm playing a romantic lead and I have this young man who is doing, you know, who loves me so hard. I mean, that's major for a dark-skinned actress with my hair texture.
You know, I was in Paris with the movie a couple weeks ago, And afterwards, in this like African French organization co-hosted the screening, so we came back for the mixer afterwards, and these four black women were just waiting to talk to me. So I went over and said, hey, what's going on? They didn't want to talk about the mass incarceration. They didn't want to talk about the love story. They wanted to talk about Kiki and her hair. And they were like, but her hair. I was like, yeah, it's her hair. They're like, but you didn't do anything to it. I was like, no, it's her hair. And they were just so shocked to see a lead like Kiki, and her hair is natural for basically the whole damn film. And I'm like, but that's her hair. You know, why would I do anything to her hair? But these things, these images don't reach us, you know, with the same frequency that other images reach us. And so when we see them, it's like,
right.
Oh my God.
Right.
I'm almost emotional listening to that story of being in Paris and what this means to you. Because people of color often, as we know, they get whitewashed out of film.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't represented. And when we are, we're often represented in some caricature of what we really are supposed mm-hmm. to be. So it's a little intense to hear that. I literally have goosebumps. You know, Barry, you've got another project coming up, though. This isn't it, right?
No, I do.
Big project here for a little company called Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Little itty-bitty company.
Little itty-bitty. We heard that they might be making some moves here in New York. And it's Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, which is gorgeously written. Is there anything you can tell us about that, or is it still too soon?
No, it's not too soon. I mean, we had a writer's room for the book, so we've written, you know, all these scripts and location scouting, all those things. I think that the most clear thing I can say about it is, you know, it's a hero's journey. And I remember as a kid, you know, hearing about the Underground Railroad for the first time and really literally imagining choo-choo trains running underground. And so I think that reading Colson's book kind of reactivated that childhood kind of awe, you know, around just like the power, the ingenuity, you know, of black folks to create this path to freedom. And I thought the best way to tell that was to go on the full hero's journey. And so I was really happy to partner with Amazon and find a place where we could tell this story over the course of 8, 9, 10 hours.
I'm excited about this. Kiki, this is your first major role. Mm-hmm. We're in a moment right now in Hollywood that, shall we say, has been challenging for race, but also mm-hmm. thinking that this is going to change for the better. We're hoping Oscars won't be so white at some point. Is there any type of storytelling or narrative or role that you're looking for as you move into your next project?
Well, my next project is an adaptation of Native Son, and so that'll be out in 2019. And so I'm thankful that my first projects are Beale Street and Native Son, because I think that lets, I don't know, people in the industry know, you know, the type of work that I am interested in and stories that I'm not afraid to tell. But in terms of what I want my career to look like, I just wanted to have a lot of variety. Like, the fun of acting is just being able to play in all these different types of worlds. And so I want to be able to tackle roles that have historically just haven't gone to actresses that look like me. Yeah, and I just want to do it all.
And do you think that we're moving in that direction? Barry, do you feel like we're moving in a place where we can, you know, where Kiki can take on some other role that would traditionally, you know, never have cast a woman of color, much less a black woman?
There is a movie with basically an all-black cast, 95% black cast, that grossed $1.7 billion this year. Mm-hmm. Little movie called Black Panther.
Heard of it, saw it.
And so I think, you know, I'm trying to find the clearest, most succinct way to say yes.
Well, Barry Jenkins, director of If Beale Street Could Talk, and Kiki Lane, who is Tish in the film, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.